content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Frank Urban for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I'll be reading to you from Smithsonian, the magazine of the Smithsonian Institution. And this, we read today from the June 2023 edition of Smithsonian, and the article is 1,000 miles to go. Putting in on the Yukon River at Whitehorse, teams of adventurers set out into the wild, negotiating dangerous rapids, braided channels, and rummaging bears on the world's longest paddle race. Oh, boy. And there's a double page here. It says 1,000 miles to go in huge print. And they, I'm sure, used a drone to take a picture of someone in one of those long, skinny paddle boats. And this is by Max Ufberg, U-F-B-E-R-G. It's not clear who first discovered the gold. Even the word discovered is a misnomer. The local Tlingit and Tagish tribes were both well aware of its presence along the river decades before Westerners started drawing it from the ground. They'd simply had no use for the stuff. Perhaps it's better to say it's not clear who first exploited the gold, who helped inspire some 100,000 prospectors to make the arduous trip to the Yukon Territory in northwest Canada, a migration that became known as the Klondike Gold Rush. Some say it was George Carmack, an enterprising American who had made a career searching for bullion in Canada and Alaska, who first found the lustrous natural resources along the bed of the Klondike River. Others credit Carmack's brother-in-law, a Tagish man named Kish, better known to the family and friends as Skookum Jim, who, some believe, ceded his right of excavation to Carmack out of fear that the Canadian government wouldn't acknowledge an indigenous claimant. Whatever the case, in 1896, Carmack staked the first federally recognized claim to the gold in that section of the tributary. Word of the precious metal's presence quickly spread through Canada and the United States. By 1897, the gold rush was in full effect, drawing in ramblers the world over, some of whom would go on to achieve phenomenal success and notoriety. People like former Washington Governor John McCraw, the Scout, Frederick Russell Burnham, Frederick Trump, businessman and grandfather of America's 45th president, and the novelist Jack London, who once wrote of the vast and mountainous region. There, you get your perspective. London's sentiment still rings true after the gold-infused stampede has died down. The untouched grandeur of the Yukon is still as intoxicating as ever, and it still attracts thousands. Only these days, many are seeking not wealth, but pure adventure. On a balmy July day, I sat with several dozen people in the Sternwheeler Hotel and Conference Center in downtown Whitehorse, a city of about 28,000 on the territory's southern edge, where a group of paddlers had come to break records and write themselves into the history of this landscape. It was there, along the chintzy chandeliers and brown carpeting, that preparations were underway for the world's longest canoe race, a 1,000-mile odyssey down the Yukon River. And the event's organizer, John Frith, was telling the competitors all the way they might perish on their journey. A racer might capsize their boat and drown, explained Firth, strict-seeming Brit, as he clicked slowly through a PowerPoint presentation, Or perhaps they'll develop severe hypothermia. Heck, even a moose could do them in if they're unlucky enough to provoke the animal. They're big old things, Firth said, and they'll just come running through the scrub. There are three divisions within the Yukon 1000, canoeing, kayaking, and stand-up paddleboarding. Racers compete in teams of two. In the case of paddleboarding, competitors each ride a separate board. Over the next hour or so, Frith continued outlining the rules, which boiled down to paddle all day, pull off the river and rest for at least 6 hours, make the time checkpoint in Dawson City, and, this last one is important, don't rely on outside help. Racers must have a GPS tracker and satellite phone. The former, so Frith can keep tabs on everyone. The latter, in the event that someone needs a helicopter rescue. Think of the worst-case scenario and plan for it, Frith said. It is really, really remote out there. He's not wrong. Starting in Whitehorse, paddlers must navigate the Yukon through rapids and a shifting maze of channels and tributaries called braiding, which occurs because of the river's high sediment loads and highly erodible bank material. As the race wears on, the route grows more and more remote, cut off from highways, spectators, and hospitals. Racers have a maximum of 9 days and 18 hours to complete the course. Should they miss the cutoff time at the checkpoint, they'll be disqualified. The race finishes in Alaska, about 130 miles northwest of Fairbanks. There's no prize money, just bragging rights. For now, the record for the fastest time set by kayak during the inaugural race in 2009 is 6 days, 2 hours, and 11 minutes. Toward the end of this sermon, excitement entered Frith's voice as he told the crowd that following an unusually rainy start to the summer, the Yukon River was moving faster than usual, up to 11 miles per hour at its quickest points. I expect records to be broken, he said with a grin. Simply getting a spot in the 2022 Yukon 1000 was more competitive than getting into an Ivy League university. Over 3,500 teams applied. Only 40 were deemed fit for the journey, and a mere 24 actually started the race. Participants must demonstrate paddling ability and wilderness acumen, and in Frith's words, must be grown up about the whole thing. That means demonstrating self-sufficiency on the river and showing complete deference to Frith, F-R-I-T-H, and his handful of volunteers. The racers each pay $3,150 Canadian for entrance and come from all over the world. Most of them looked manic. At least that's how it seemed to me as I watched them prepare for launch the next morning. On the bank of the Yukon River in downtown Whitehorse, a small contingent of paddle-clutching friends raced to secure sundry items to their vessels. Food, clothing, water purifiers, bear spray, also apparently effective on moose, maps, satellite phones, all lashed down to their respective conveyances. Among the competitors scurrying about were kayakers Daniel Stogdahl of Bend, Indiana, Jason Magnus of Tucson, Arizona. The team name, Bend Racing, who have been adventuring together for 20 years. They've won several international expedition contests, including the Everglades Challenge, and were featured on the 2020 Amazon Prime reality series, World's Toughest Race Echo Challenge Fiji. Other competitors also boast a history of daring do. Stand-up paddlers Ella Osterholt and Janice Smits, veterans of the same competitive racing rafting team, that is, in the Netherlands, or canoeer Toby Fenwick Clennell, that's a hyphenated name, Fenwick Clennell, who rode from the Canary Islands to Antigua in 39 days back in 2016, and his paddling partner, Will Goodwin. Or stand-up paddleboard racer, Scott Based, half of Pirates of the Yukon, with his partner, Bradley Friesen, who owns a paddling shop in the Florida Keys and gets on the water about 2 hours or 3 hours every day. But not everybody was here to chase a world record. Some were simply aiming to finish. One such competitor was Dean Redding of Bangor, Maine. Redding had wanted to compete in the stand-up paddleboard category a few years ago, but a metastatic cancer diagnosis put that idea on hold. Now, after a year of immunotherapy, the cancer was undetectable, and Redding felt strong enough to give the race an honest shot. Not on a paddleboard, but in a canoe with his friend Mark Reisinger. Redding told me he was looking for any way I can find my bliss in nature. Finally, with everyone's gear secured, Frith shouted for a huddle. One of the participants, Glenn Nolan, a member of the Cree Nation in Ontario, instructed everyone to take a thimble's worth of tobacco and offer it to the river for guidance along the way, a Cree tradition. Then it was back to Frith, who sought to inspire the racers with a quotation from the British-Canadian poet Robert Service, born in 1874, known as the Bard of the Yukon. This is the law of the Yukon, and ever she makes it plain. Send not your foolish and feeble. Send me your strong and your sane. By now it was about noon, and the atmosphere was a strange mix of communion and conquest, with a dash of chaos. A minute before Frith called the racers to their marks, a canoeist named Kelly Linklater, half of Team Savage, walked from the riverbank to a small grassy patch where the spectators stood to ask if I wouldn't mind driving his truck the 589 miles to Fairbanks. "Can I just do that?" I asked him, already apprehensive about driving someone else's vehicle across an international border in the States. "It's fine," he assured me. "Just tell them you're with the race when you get to the border." As we spoke, his wife and teammate, Naomi Umphrey, yelled for him to get over to the starting line. I muttered something about how I would get the car back to him in one piece, but by then he was already running back to the water's edge. Some of the teams paddled in silence. Some chattered to stave off fatigue. Some played music on portable speakers, classic rock, jazz, rap. Over the coming days, they would slog through rain and lightning and even a brief hailstorm. By the second day, a hierarchy had emerged, with Bend Racing already at the head of the pack, having pulled through some 210 miles of river. I left Whitehorse at dawn the next day to drive about 2 hours to meet the racers. Well, to see them as they pass through the Five Finger Rapids, a challenging section that finds the river divided by basalt columns into five whitewater channels. Frith had met a local fisherman Ray Fowle a few days before, who promised he would take us out on his boat for a more intimate view of the action. Of course, Frith needed to be close by during that treacherous stretch. So what would he have done if he had never met Fowle? At just the way this goes, Frith assured me. It always works out. He wasn't wrong. After parking Linklater's truck in a small clearing in a park a few miles from the rapids, I wandered to a secluded slipway and hopped aboard Fowle's worn purple jet boat. In a matter of minutes, he was zipping me and Frith over a second adjacent to the rapids. This was to be one of the few and final vantage points we'd get of the teams after they passed through Eagle, a border town on the Alaska side, another 360-some miles beyond our current location. The racers were totally alone, inaccessible to spectators, and even Frith could only catch the action via a series of tricky overlooks along the route and his GPS screen. Parked at the bank, surrounded by the sound of rushing water and jagged islands of rock, we waited for the cruise. As we bobbed in the current, hitched by rope to a tree on the river's edge, Frith stared out at the imposing rock formations jutting into the water. These rocks could tell some stories, eh? He mused. Frith, who had spent 30 years as a soldier in the British Army, a veteran of combat in Bosnia, Afghanistan, and Iraq. The military is behind him now. These days he's a husband and father of two living outside Winchester, England. But part of him still yearns for the old excitement. Frith did his first Yukon 1000 in 2016, placing second overall. By 2018, he was running the event. I'm pretty comfortable in chaos, he told me that morning. I get a thrill of it. Still, he is constantly on guard, lest he lose someone. From start to finish, I worry, he told me. And it's not because I run the race. It's because I like all these people. Their families are messaging me constantly. It's a little micro-community, and you're trying to reassure them that you're looking after them. He would spend his nights by the fire, checking the racers' GPS signals, and keeping an eye open to the competitors' families, sleeping just a few hours. We'd all been studying the GPS trackers that morning on phones and computers, so it was no surprise when Bend Racing Team entered our sight line, shooting through the rapids far ahead of the competition. Magnus and Stadigal paddling smoothly through the white water. We watched them until their kayak was again just a dot on the horizon, and we were once more left with nothing but serenity and the conjecture of who might have traveled these waterways in centuries past. If you came down here 1,000 years ago in a birch bark canoe, nothing has changed, Frith says. The scenery hasn't changed. Only the quarry for those folks is different. Not gold or fish, but a singular experience in the 21st century, when much of the world has more money and better technology than it's ever known, people long for suffering, at least a controlled form of it. This is very exciting. I'm going to have to jump over here. You might hear the pages rattle. I tried to shake it off. Okay, man, you're seeing things, he recalled when he craned his neck to get another glance at the creature he saw that the being had, in a matter of seconds, inexplicably moved to the other side of the water. He didn't mention anything to his wife until the next day, not wanting to cause her any additional stress. Linklater had no idea whether what he saw was real. The creature exists in his Cree tradition, and he trusts his eyes. On the other hand, he knows as well as I do that exhaustion can lead to hallucination. All Linklater can do is chalk it up to one of the river's many mysteries, something worth chasing again and again. Like the 19th century miners whose trail they had traced, the paddlers had their own dreams and visions of the water. When I spoke with Linklater later in September, he'd just been encouraged to apply for the next Yukon 1000. I asked whether he was considering accepting this next challenge. He answered without pause, "I'm tempted." The fortitude of the competitors, brings to mind the French literary theorist Roland Barthes, who wrote while watching the Tour de France in 1957, "The racer is at grips, not with some natural difficulty, but with a veritable theme of existence." Of course, Barthes was talking about the fanciest of sporting contests, a place where the luxury watched sponsored after parties are as famous as the course itself. Here, there's no material reward for whoever successfully grapples in the unforgiving Yukon with the question of what keeps us alive. And now we switch to the discussion page at the beginning of Smithsonian. "Fighting fire with fire. Every year my heart breaks at the devastation loss from forest fires, wildfires." This is referring to the story Under Control from last month. "It is heartening to learn that communities are coming together to take the lead in preventing this loss and devastation. It seems counterintuitive to burn to prevent fires, but the data shows that it works. Going back to the old ways isn't always a bad thing." That's from Kay Spinzia from Queens, New York. "For too long, many folks have looked at the government for answers when, in fact, programs like these work so much better. What an uplifting story about citizens helping each other. The results speak for themselves, and if government programs continue, they should be modeled after these citizen initiatives. Wildfires are here to stay and will no doubt expand in intensity. These programs are needed not just for the survival of residents, but the forests themselves." That's Thomas Foster from Eugene, Oregon. These are people writing in from last month's Smithsonian, if I didn't make that clear. "Inside Westminster, Crowns, Choirs, and Crypts" from the April-May edition tells the history of the Abbey and evokes the spiritual mystique of the place at the same time. The world so recently mourned the Queen there. We can see Charles III's coronation in the context of the progression of historical events that have taken place in this hallowed space. Thank you for history. Thank you for introducing us to the people devoted to its care and management. Thank you for including the garden. Colleen Dwyer Crawford from Indio, California. "I absolutely love this article. It makes me want to go back to London for another visit. I could almost smell the musty aroma of ancient and not so ancient British history. I hoist a pint to Edward, the Confessor, and all who came after him." Don Luckenbill of Los Angeles. "Powered by methane. Waste Not" from the April-May edition was fascinating and even electrifying, but I got short-circuited when I discovered that you identified a pair of boot-foot chest waders as well-worn overalls. I'd be wearing those waders if I worked in the Goodrich farm. John Stenard of Poplar Bluff, Missouri. In a time when there is so much discouraging coverage of climate change, warming of Earth, and climate catastrophes, it was uplifting to read about a safe and sane way to use methane for power while avoiding the use of manure, which could pollute nearby streams and land through runoff. What a win-win scenario. Thanks for a great article, which left me hopeful. And this is Institutional Knowledge, again in the front of the Smithsonian. Treasures and Troubles. A renowned blues archivist uncovers a rich musical history and poses questions about a historian's responsibility to his subjects. Often curating an exhibition is about getting out of the way of the story and allowing the collections to speak for themselves. That is not the case for Treasures in Trouble, Looking Inside a Legendary Blues Archive, a new show at the National Museum of American History about the folklorist Robert Mac McCormick and his expansive archive on blues artists in Texas and the Deep South from the early 1900s through the 1970s. McCormick began collecting material from the 1950s and continued until his death in 2015. His archive, covering hundreds of artists, is among the world's largest, most significant collection on the blues and other vernacular musical traditions. The exhibition, however, is as much about the process of curation and collection for the Smithsonian curators, and certainly for McCormick himself, as it is about the material. The exhibition space doubles as the entryway to the Archive Center, which houses McCormick's collection of more than 590 reels of sound recordings and 165 boxes of materials, totaling over 70 cubic feet of manuscripts, interviews, research notes, and more. The collection will be open to the public and available online. The left side of the entryway features a selection of the archival treasures promised in the show's title. And that's going to wrap it up for us. I hope you've enjoyed this as much as I have bringing it to you. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Frank Urban for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's program is underwritten with the generous support of the Kepin family, and we thank them for their support. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138.